KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Rendition has become to many a dirty word, one that signifies covert operations of kidnapping that inevitably results in torture. We'll hear all about rendition in the hour ahead as we delve into the history of clandestine operations involving rendition and troubling moral questions of whether they ever should be permissible, even if they wind up gaining vital information or saving lives. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Rendition has been receiving a great deal of attention recently, both here and abroad, with mass media coverage, a motion picture with Reese Witherspoon, documentaries, and international press coverage. In law, rendition means to surrender or to return, and it has come to mean everything from snatching those suspected to have terrorist ties who are subsequently taken to another country to be interrogated to the suspected widespread outsourcing of torture. This forum hour, we turn our attention to rendition, and joining us here in studio is Stephen Gray, who is an investigative journalist and director of the PBS Frontline World Program Extraordinary Rendition, which airs tonight at 10 p.m. on KQED. He's also the author of a book called Ghost Plane, The True Story of the CIA Rendition and Torture Program. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Morning to you. Trevor Paglen also joins us in studio. He's the author of a book with A.C. Thompson called Torture Taxi on the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you both here, and let me begin, Stephen Gray, with you. Actually, perhaps we ought to get a little bit of a historical background here. I'm looking at a statement out of WashingtonPost.com where it says, rendition is not necessarily what many people have come to associate it with, which is just almost torture and taking people to different countries. Certainly, it always had to do with different countries. In fact, Israelis' abduction of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann, I guess, was a form of rendition, really, or
right.
When they took him out of Argentina. But it's changed in the Bush administration. Maybe we ought to begin there, really.
That's right. Well, I think, to be fair, the change began under President Clinton. But you have a policy of rendition, snatching someone, taking them to another country. The key thing is without any legal process. It's not extradition. There's no court hearing. And that's taken place since actually the 1880s in the U.S. We've snatched people abroad and brought them back to justice. But it was to justice. So you can think of General Noriega in Panama being brought home, Ramzi Youssef behind the first World Trade Center bombing, brought back to the U.S., put on trial. And that's the traditional form of overt rendition. And what we're talking about here is covert rendition, extraordinary rendition, as it's come to be called. And that means sending people not back to the U.S., not back to a courtroom, not back to justice, but to a foreign country. And the countries of choice have been countries like Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, even Libya, Uzbekistan, which are the countries that also torture people and where the interrogations that these people have received.
And forgive me, even Syria. You begin your book talking about a place in Syria that came to be known as the Grave, and here's a state that's been labeled and indicted as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Yeah, that's the one that the administration doesn't want you to talk about because it's been so clearly labeled as a state sponsor of terrorism, but it's also a country that is at war with an opposition which is largely Islamist and has been very happy to cooperate with the U.S. in detaining and interrogating people that are opponents to its regime and people and has wanted to help the U.S. in the war on terror. But the torture involved there is extreme, as everyone in the CIA knew. People held in a prison called the Palestine Branch, an interrogation center, really. Cells 3 foot by 6 foot wide, as long as 3 foot, 6 foot wide, as the dimensions of a grave, and that's like coffins, and people held there for months and months on end.
In fact, we have a cut, actually, of one of those who was held there. Maher Arar, who was a Canadian citizen, was rendered to Syria, testified on October 18th in front of Congress, and was on video conference, and you might give a little background to this, if you would, Stephen Gray. I mean, to his particular case, because it's so egregious. I mean, this is a man who was held and who is incontrovertibly innocent of any of the charges.
Yes, there was an official inquiry in Canada, looked at all the secret intelligence, and that was including information shared from the United States, and said he was completely innocent. But at the time of his capture, they had linked him to suspected terrorists. People actually turned out not to be terrorists at all. It was a sort of chain of connections that proved to be wrong. He was changing planes, heading home to Canada, and changing planes at John F. Kennedy Airport. This was in September 2002. They held him in New York and then put him on a plane, first to Jordan and then drove him over the border into Syria. It was a very deliberate act. He protested at the time.
Quite a plane, too. I mean, it was like an executive's...
Well, that's always been the sort of surreal aspect of this whole rendition program, the use of these business jets. Luxury jets. He was actually could watch him. They offered him a movie to watch. He was sitting there shackled
near a champagne stand and all that.
Yeah, and he could watch.
In chains.
Right, and he could watch the progress of the movie. And they offered him a very nice meal at the end of the journey. But he was thinking to himself that he was like being fed as some sort of lamb to the slaughter, because all that was on his mind was the fate that awaited him in Syria. Because he knew what happens in Syria.
Now, here in his own words, we're going to hear some of his testimony.
On October 8th, at 3 in the morning, I was awakened and told that they had decided to remove me to Syria. By then, it was becoming more and more clear to me that I was being sent to Syria for the purpose of being tortured. There, I was put in a dark, underground cell that was more like a grave. It was 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high. Life in that cell was hell. I spent 10 months and 10 days in that grave. During the early days of my detention, I was interrogated and physically tortured. I was beaten with an electrical cable and threatened with a metal chair, the tire, and electric shocks. I was forced to falsely confess that I had been to Afghanistan. When I was not being beaten, I was put in a waiting room so that I could hear the screams of other prisoners. The cries of the women still haunt me the most.
That's testimony that was given about rendition by Maher Arar, and again, a Canadian citizen, we should emphasize.
Yeah, he wasn't alone. That's the other thing I found out, was there were 8 other prisoners in the same jail cells that had all come courtesy of the United States. He's got out to tell his story. But there are other pretty major prisoners that were sent there that aren't able to describe what happened because they're still locked away.
Well, he got out, but, you know, I read the whole testimony, and it's a horror story. I mean, he's still plagued by psychological suffering, by nightmares, it's affected his professional life as an engineer, it's affected his personal life with his family, and it's just an ongoing dreadful trauma. And when we're talking about extraordinary rendition, what are we talking about?
Well, it means sending. It's the difference between rendition to justice. It's a special form of rendition, and it's completely secret. I mean, until this moment, the administration has confirmed only the existence of a program, but won't confirm any individual case. Won't actually say who we sent to which countries. And the importance of that secrecy is it essentially protects the torturer, because insofar as you don't have any accountability of what you've done with people, there's no way of following the trail of people and actually, you know, going to the government's concerned and finding out what's happened to many of these different people. But extraordinary rendition is specifically handing over, outsourcing the interrogation and detention of people to other governments.
And the sense of this going on is, I mean, you make the analogy to what Solzhenitsyn writes about in the gulags. I mean, we're not talking about anything that extensive, but in a sort of miniature way, it's quite similar.
Yes, because it's an archipelago of prisons, you know, scattered around the world. And I mean, I make the parallel with Solzhenitsyn's description of the gulag, not because of anything to do with the numbers involved, but he describes the whole gulag as a parallel world that exists right next to us. It wasn't just in Siberia. People were taken around in vans that labeled bread around Moscow, and there were prisons and people held in major cities. And he describes it as a fantasy world, by meaning it has this sort of surreal quality where people have things going on right next to them but shut their eyes and don't want to ask the questions to find out what's happening to their next-door neighbor. And you see with this extraordinary rendition program the use of airports right next door to us, planes flying through our airspace, and prisons sometimes right next door to where we all go. And if you're going to Cairo, you can take a tourist ride on the River Nile, take a sunset cruise, sip a glass of wine, and you can see the watchtowers of Al Toura prison, which is the biggest center where thousands of people have been taken and tortured by the Egyptian authorities. But we can shut our eyes to it if we don't really ask the questions.
Stephen Gray, again, is an investigative journalist and director of the PBS Frontline World Program Extraordinary Rendition. It will air tonight on Channel 9, KQED, at 10 p.m. And he's also the author of Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA rendition and torture program. And Trevor Paglen is the author with A.C. Thompson of Torture Taxi on the trail of the CIA's rendition flights. And we've already gotten a picture of some of these business jets, Trevor, and they were unmarked civilian planes in many cases, what you call torture taxis. How'd you get a track on these? I mean, you really did some sleuthing.
Well, I think different people kind of came to this idea independent of one another. Stephen discovered that one of the contradictions in this program is that the CIA has created a series of front companies to do these renditions, to fly these aircraft, and they can take advantage of civilian international aviation law in order to do this, meaning the CIA can fly to, they can fly to Karachi, Pakistan. And the military can't do that. That would be an act of war. But international aviation law, civilians can fly wherever they want. Now, the contradiction comes because even if they're setting up these sorts of front companies, they have to file the same kinds of paperwork that any other legal business has to file. This means there have to be registration records on file with the FAA. And it goes even so far as they have to register their flight plans with the Federal Aviation Administration and with Eurocontrol. And for very good reasons, the aviation industry is obviously highly regulated, and this is all essentially public information. So you can get, by looking at the records of these aircraft, you can not only get a sense of who owns them, what kind of infrastructure is set up domestically in order to support this program, but you can start to draw maps. You can start to see relationships between the places that these aircraft frequent. And this can be a thread that you can start to pull on and to start to learn something about the global geography of this program and something about the timelines involved, the places that are important. You can start to correlate dates of flight plans to people's stories who've maybe been kidnapped and tortured and held somewhere incommunicado and gotten out, and we'll
which
tell
allows
these stories.
For corroboration of the stories.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what kind of stories were you hearing that led you to do the kind of investigative work you did as far as flight plans and the like?
Well, for me, it started actually with a different project where I was looking at secret military sites in Nevada, and some friends of mine started seeing very unusual aircraft flying in and out of restricted airspace in Nevada.
These are desert spaces.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew how to follow airplanes around. You started following these things around. You'd see flights to Guantanamo Bay, flights to Libya. I had a friend who was an air traffic controller in the UK who would send me things. And this was late 2002, so it kind of piqued my interest. And then as more and more information came out, you started to see correlations between what these aircraft were doing and these kinds of stories.
And we're able to see correlation particularly with respect to some of these harsh and interrogations that involve torture.
Yeah.
Testimony of that line.
Yeah, so for example, Khaled al-Masri was kidnapped in Macedonia in early 2003, and he shows up on the side of a road in Albania a few months later. He was a German citizen, he goes back home and starts to tell this story about having been kidnapped by the CIA, held at some black site in Afghanistan, and it really was a hard story to believe, but then you could start to correlate a lot of the details of his story to things that you could confirm, for example, flight records, but other things as well.
Again, we're talking about rendition. That's Trevor Paglen, who's the author with A.C. Thompson of Torture Taxi on the trail of the CIA's rendition flights, and I'm interested in what each of you has to say, and we'll hear from Dana Rohrbach, who probably presents a very different point of view in his orations about rendition. But the arguments often about this kind of rendition that leads to torture, outsourcing of torture and so forth, is that Well, you know, nobody would complain if we had captured bin Laden, let's say, taken him out of the streets of Karachi and brought him to somewhere like Syria or wherever, Egypt, Uzbekistan. And the other argument you hear, of course, is that which you always hear about torture from those who give their imprimatur to it, although the government has pretty much tried to separate itself, obviously, from any of this kind of torture. But what you hear in the way of an argument advanced is it saved lives. We can't tell you, of course, the CIA will say, but we know, and you should know, that it saved lives. And I'm curious to know the response that each of you have to that.
Yeah, but even
Stephen
if you,
Gray?
Yeah, I mean, if you caught Osama bin Laden, of course, what you'd want to do is hold him for the rest of his life. And if you live in a country of laws, you have to do that through the laws that you have. And if you've proceeded to torture that individual, you'd probably have a bit of difficulty getting that through the court, even if it was Osama bin Laden. But I think the key point is you need to get information. How are you going to go about doing that? After 9/11, the intelligence agencies were given the mission of finding the people responsible and capturing them. What did they do? They were short of people to interrogate. They didn't have the black site prisons, their own prisons established. Some of the first and most important prisoners that they interrogated, they captured, were not held in U.S. custody but rendered. A prisoner called Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi was captured in the end of 2001. And rather than being questioned by the FBI, he was taken from them and handed over to the Egyptians. George Tenet confirmed that last year in his book. He said that he was the most important prisoner in U.S. hands, and he was sent for a debriefing to the Egyptians. So here's an example of rendition specifically used for outsourcing of torture. You mentioned the important information we needed, and we did need important information, but his interrogation in Egypt cost thousands of lives. It didn't save thousands of lives. It cost thousands of lives. And the reason is, under torture, he came up with a story saying that Saddam Hussein was training al-Qaeda in the use of chemical and biological weapons. That's declassified, confirmed official information. And
it went right to Secretary Powell, in fact, didn't it?
Exactly. Powell announced it. Of course, General Powell didn't mention that he was being held in Egypt at the time he was making his statement, and that was the source of this information. But when he finally came back into U.S. custody, by the way, he's disappeared now. He hasn't emerged anywhere. He told the story how he was held in a box 50 centimeters, 20 inches by 20 inches, and effectively buried alive for 17 hours, and then he came up with the story. So you have to ask yourself, what is the best way of getting good information? Now, people under extreme forms of interrogation, like torture, will talk. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if he has been waterboarded, as we're told, certainly came up with some very useful information, but he also came up with some bogus information. If you want to deal with information you can act on, you need to know it's reliable. There's so much intelligence around. The threat reports coming any day come in by the hundreds. The agencies responsible and the American people need to have good information. That's why more sophisticated and legal methods, if you speak to people who do these sort of interrogations, they'll tell you those are the way to go.
Well, they'll argue for legal review as being essential, and they'll also argue for higher evidentiary standards. And yet, here's Dana Rohrabach. And by the way, what we're hearing here is a cut from this Republican congressman from California defending the rendition program at the same hearing that you heard Maher Arar testify.
Today's hearing is an attempt to do away with rendition. That's my interpretation. Maybe I'm wrong. You'll have to let me know whether or not that's a wrong interpretation. A government program, rendition, is used to fight our war against radicals who want to end our way of life and are willing to murder thousands, if not millions, of civilians in order to terrorize the populations of the Western democracies into retreat and submission. Those of us who want to end this program will use Mr. Arar's tragic case, which resulted from government error and error of those people who are involved in the program, to prove that the rendition program has no merit. As I say, we do have to, number one, admit the error, also understand that this was 1 year after 9/11.
That's California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, Republican, essentially saying that renditions are often really the only option for interrogating a suspect or bringing him to justice when extradition is not politically or legally possible. And Trevor Paglen, some thoughts on that?
Well, the only argument you'll really ever hear for this kind of interrogation, from these enhanced interrogation techniques, as they call them, is this ticking time bomb argument, the idea that you've captured somebody on the battlefield and they know about some imminent plot and they're not going to tell you unless you torture them. And if you torture them, then you can get the information and save the day. Now, the problem with that is that it's never happened. This is a... It's an ethical kind of thought.
Unless it's television.
It happens on television. It actually goes back to the French occupation of Algeria. There was a novel that came out called Les Centurions that made this. It was fiction. It was a myth, and that's where the myth comes from. But in real life, it's never happened. And if you talk to anybody who's been involved in this and you ask them an example where this ticking time bomb scenario has actually played out, you won't find one.
It's not only the ticking time bomb that you hear, though. Those who defend rendition, and it's curious to me how many American officials have dissociated themselves from torture, knowing that perhaps that was the inevitable result of a rendition. But nevertheless, the argument you hear is this is the only process that's available for us to get intelligence and get good intelligence. It's not even necessarily saving lives. It's finding out where the enemy is, or particularly after 9/11, you know, the concern about where they were holing up, that kind of thing. Don't seem to be able to find bin Laden or any of his minions, but nevertheless, that's the argument you hear.
The people often confuse when they make the defensive rendition as you just heard, you've got to draw the distinction between legal renditions and these covert extraordinary renditions. And there's no doubt that picking people up, scooping them up when they're plotting crimes, and you've got evidence of those crimes, is a tactic that has worked and is effective. But those are the renditions we spoke about before, people brought back to justice. These did not involve that process. But more broadly, I think there's also a distinction you've got to make between what you do as a short-term tactic and what are going to be the effects of what you do. I mean, Trevor just mentioned the Algerian War, and the French found it very effective in the Battle of Algiers. The French paratroopers went and practiced mass torture on the suspects they interrogated and were able to roll up the entire cell structure of their opposition in Algiers. But the consequence of that was the country was completely divided back home in France, and the support for the war ended. And the rest of Algeria rose up, and what became a minority struggle was a majority struggle. And a lot of people from the CIA actually share that kind of analysis, in that they see that they were rolled into these short-term measures when the war they're fighting is a war really for public opinion in the Middle East, in the Arab and Islamic world. And the consequences of taking these very short-term measures, when you see the reaction you get, not just from the people in general, but the families of people who've been tortured and the people themselves once they're released.
You have interviewed people, though, like CIA operatives and pilots and people in the White House even, who have said this is a vital program, right?
I have. But most of those people are very candid about the fact that it did involve torture, that they, while they defended, they knew these people would be tortured. And so they acknowledge as a deep legal problem that this whole thing may be illegal. And secondly, those that defend it in general as a sort of grey area tactic, which was used because the political alternatives weren't there. I met one person, a case officer, who was actually had a rendition victim. He'd captured some terrorists. He had them in his hands. He had all the evidence. He would have preferred to send them back to the U.S. to be put in a U.S. jail because he had all the evidence. But there was no political will, either in the agency or in the White House, for that to happen. So he was left with a tactic which he approved of only as a second-best option. It's not the best way of dealing with it.
Well, the program is back on. The rendition program is back on. And we're going to invite you to join us with any questions or comments you might have about rendition. We welcome your calls. You can join us toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or join us by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. We continue with your calls and emails with Stephen Gray and Trevor Paglen. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the U.S. government's rendition program, under which the Central Intelligence Agency transfers terrorism suspects to foreign countries to be held and interrogated, and you are welcome to join us. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, and I want to read a few emails here before we go to your calls. Again, we're talking to Trevor Paglen, co-author of Tortured Taxi on the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, and Stephen Gray, who is the director of the PBS Frontline World Program that will air tonight on Channel 9 on KQED, called Extraordinary Rendition. He's also the author of Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA rendition and torture program. Here's Michael, who says the effects of torture do not end when the captive is released. In World War II, my father was captured by the Japanese in the Philippines and rendered to Japan, where he was held and tortured for nearly 3 years. My entire family has suffered and continues to suffer consequences of that despicable act to this day. I'm unable to reconcile the America of that time that fought against such atrocities with today's Bush-Cheney America that instead commits them despite our president's lies to the contrary. Well, actually, I think it's safe to say that Cheney kind of telegraphed this when he said he was going to go over to the dark side. We're seeing the results of that in what we're talking about here today. Alan writes, American-controlled rendition needs to be stopped immediately. If we don't fight it in the Middle East, we'll end up fighting it here at home. The worst effect of rendition of foreigners is that it threatens people in America directly, that a tyrant in America could use rendition against us when we oppose tyranny. This powerful threat, so reminiscent of what was done in tyrannies elsewhere, is the top of a long slide into oppression of Americans in place of our precious democracy. And Matt says the Afghans have a saying, something like, what you do to your enemies today, you do to your friends tomorrow. How long before we have our own citizens tortured? Here's a question from Phil who says, U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee could investigate rendition, but has avoided it. Why? Stephen Gray.
I don't know if you saw the movie Rendition. It's quite interesting depiction of Washington there, which I think is quite accurate, in that there was a senator there who basically said, you know, tell me the guy's 100% innocent, and then I'll intervene. And, you know, am I going to stick my neck out for someone who might turn out to be a terrorist? And I think that is actually how it's worked out in Washington. You hear them holding hearings about Meher Arar, and he's a good case. But the fact is he's been declared innocent officially. And it's very politically convenient to investigate only that case. But what about people like Al Libby, who is no doubt an Al-Qaeda camp commander, but was still treated in that way? And then Congress so far has, I think, dared to take that kind of case up. And all I can conclude is that there is a constant election process here, and delving into these aspects of the war on terror is very politically, would be very politically courageous. On the other hand, you know, this war is going to go on a very long time. A new president's going to deal with the same challenges, the same programs. And in some way, if you don't confront these issues and work out what you think is right or wrong, these same issues will just keep bubbling up again.
Well, you mentioned Meher Arar, and as I said, that his innocence has really been proven beyond any serious shadow of a doubt. But there are some weird turns to that whole case, in that he was particularly identified with another Canadian of similar Arabic background. And they kept asking him about this person in the interrogations, and then he saw him at the grave there in Syria. I mean, the person he had been identified with, whom he knew just somewhat vaguely, really.
It's a sort of chain of links. One person knows one person in one
place. Exactly.
And you can just see how intelligence goes wrong there, because Abdullah al-Malki also, I believe, completely innocent as well.
Yes.
But he also knew somebody else, and they sort of went from one person to the other, and all of a sudden they called it a cell. They called it the Ottawa cell. But it just, as this sort of intelligence has unraveled, they've realized that they just followed a false trail.
Well, we're going to go to our callers, and let's do that forthwith. In fact, Patrick, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, your guest actually just brought up a point that I was thinking about when I heard the Republican senator, I believe, speak. And
congressman.
That idea of a congressman. Yes, thank you. I think people who support this rendition, it must go to, I mean, I'm just speculating, but it must go to the gut idea of, if somebody came into my house, I'm a new father, my wife had a baby 5 days ago, and I'm thinking that if somebody came in my house and was going to harm my wife or my baby, I would kill them. And I'm not a violent guy. I'm a vegetarian, for God's sake. But I would do that.
By the way, so was Hitler. Excuse me. It doesn't necessarily make you nonviolent. Yeah.
Right. Well, I am a nonviolent guy, but that's what I would do. But I don't think that's what people go with on their gut. But I don't think that's what rendition should be equated to. What rendition should be equated to is that I go out to all my neighbors who I don't really like the way they look, or they have some association that I don't agree with, and I kill all of them just to be safe. And I think if people think of it on that level, that's different than you're actually coming into my house. So that statement that if you prove he's innocent, then we won't have to go and do this. And that's just wrong thinking. That's not what American foundation and fundamentals are built upon.
Well, I thank you for the call. Of course, Trevor Paglen, you've heard the argument before. This is a war against terror. And because it's a war against terror, you need these torture taxis to ferret people over to find out whatever information or intelligence you're able to gather.
One of the things that people don't talk about that much, but I think is important to think about, especially at this moment, is to think about the continuities in this culture going back to the 70s and the 80s that I think are very much a part of this rendition thing. Specifically, I'm thinking about the rise of the prison system. You think about the rise of the prison system in California. We have this war on drugs, and you have this kind of lock them up and throw away the key mentality. We go in the early 80s from having about 30,000 people in California prisons to now we're up to about 180,000 people. These kind of three strikes, you're out, get tough on crime. This kind of cultural mentality that I think feeds into this rendition thing as well. You know, in terms of, think about the Willie Horton kind of scenario. Again, this goes back to the movie about, you know, is there any chance whatsoever that somebody's going to get out and do something? Well, and if there is, then lock them up and throw away the key, disappear them.
We go to more of your calls. Paul, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, quick comment about Dana Rohrabacher and about Dianne Feinstein. You know, Rohrabacher was elected back in 88 or 90 with the help of Oliver North, who campaigned for him in Long Beach. And, you know, Oliver North thought it was a neat idea to sell arms to the Iranians to fund the Contras fighting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So Rohrabacher has no credibility. Regarding Feinstein, of course, you know, she voted to send Mukasey's nomination to the full Senate, basically betraying California's you know, any Californians who have any kind of conscience or awareness that Mukasey is as dangerous, if not more so, than Alberto Gonzalez, and is not fit to be Attorney General. He's not going to uphold the laws of the land, and he doesn't even know the definition of torture. And for Dianne Feinstein to approve that, you know, I think she needs to be recalled, and people need to get behind a recall Feinstein campaign as soon as possible, because she apparently doesn't want to check the imperial presidency, which is willing to render people to foreign countries where they're tortured or allow torture.
Well, let's talk about what you bring up about Mukasey, because it's so important and it's very much in the news now. And that kind of waterboarding is something that we saw really going on in these rendition programs, did we not, Stephen Gray?
In the CIA's own prisons, I mean, the methods used in countries like Egypt, Syria are even more extreme. You know, electric shocks, sexual assault, you name it, burying people alive. The key thing about waterboarding is not that it was used very widely. I think it was only used in a handful of cases by the CIA. But two things. One, it is most definitely torture. To use the legal definition of torture here, it shocks the conscience. Anyone who actually sees it is shocked beyond belief, doesn't want to be in the same room as this going on. It was used by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. It is not simulated drowning. It is actual drowning. The lungs fill with water. And it's only through the intervention of doctors who say stop that this thing doesn't continue. The second thing about waterboarding and these special CIA techniques is, in contrast to rendition, where the CIA essentially kept rendition to foreign countries, where the CIA effectively kept its eyes shut to what was happening. They stood out the room, allowed these things to occur. The techniques like waterboarding used in the CIA's own facilities were carefully controlled, and therefore they weren't the operation of the night shift at Abu Ghraib. They were techniques that go all the way to the president, specifically authorized by the president of the United States and controlled all the way down. There's something quite chilling and cold-blooded about that whole waterboarding story, because it implicates everyone. And perhaps that's why the Democrats in Congress see the opportunity to question that particular subject.
You know, it gets complicated, though, in the sense that Gonzalez was clearly countenancing a lot of this torture that we're talking about. And he had John Yoo over at UC Berkeley giving him Geneva Protocol interpretation. And yet, waterboarding, I mean, if we were, say, a Supreme Court candidate who was being questioned, say, case by case, you know, I can't say I'm for abortion or against abortion until I look at the legal case. And to some extent, some of Mukasey's defenders have been saying the same thing, you know, that he's going to be the top officer of the land. How can he make a blank statement about waterboarding without saying it's case by case?
I think that there is a reasonable point there, that, you know, if you are the person who makes the final judgment, you've got to hear out the arguments. I mean, if he's effectively the judge, he's got to judge these points. Until he's actually been briefed into the program, it's quite difficult to just to say that, you know, he should make a definitive verdict on it. I think, but on the other hand, you know, this has become a kind of litmus test, really, of what is important here. And I suppose once they've had the confirmation, they've lost the chance to bear on this issue again. So that's why it's become so important.
So you were talking about Libby before, and I think it's in your book where you talk about this agent bringing him to Egypt and saying, I mean, all kinds of ways to torture, saying to him very emphatically, "I'm going to find your mother, and I'm going to blank her." I mean, that kind of thing is pretty common in rendition, I guess, isn't it? You know, these are looked at as criminals, terrorists. We're going to torture them. We're going to psychologically torture them.
Yes, I mean, the psychology of it all is in some ways the worst thing about it. I mean, it's just as much torture to torture someone psychologically. And Solzhenitsyn, I mentioned before, he said that, you know, the KGB didn't use medieval methods of torture. Once you had the modern psychiatrist, you could put away the rack and pinion and you could go to psychology. If someone is held without trial in a dark room in solitary confinement in cold conditions, he doesn't know what's going to happen to him in the future, how long he's going to be held, and he doesn't know to what length his interrogators will go. That person can be destroyed psychologically in a way that is just as comparable in its damage as a beating or a waterboarding that might last only a few weeks.
You say he. These are mostly men who are taken, of course, but there are women involved in, from what I've been reading of the narratives, involved in the torturing. The inquisitions or the interrogation, certainly.
Yes, there are women in the CIA and contractors who are women, and it's quite striking that there are a lot of people in the CIA who've seen these things or have been briefed on them who are utterly convinced that what's going on is torture, and and you mentioned legal authorities that did exist from Alberto Gonzalez down. They didn't really believe them. That's the problem. They saw these pieces of paper and they thought, well, I'm seeing torture. Is this legal authority really going to stand? And that's why we're hearing some of this controversy inside the agency is sort of filtered out, because there's a lot of people involved who've hired lawyers who are thinking, you know, one of these days we're going to be in court for this sort of thing.
And Stephen Gray is the director of the PBS Frontline World Program, which you can see tonight on KQED television. And he's been awarded as an investigative journalist by Amnesty International. We're going to go to more of your calls here. And William from Belvedere, good morning.
Yes, thank you. I've never heard this discussed, and I'd appreciate the comments of your guest with respect to it. Excuse me. It seems illogical to me that one would expect that torturing people who fairly routinely are perfectly willing to blow themselves up and therefore kill themselves, that the concept that, boy, we're going to torture you, now you're in real trouble because we're going to torture you, when the person would just as soon blow themselves up, is somehow going to achieve these people giving you information they want to give, that you want to get. And I'd appreciate the comments of your guests.
Actually, I read a defense of torture by a former CIA official who was asked that same question. So I'm not speaking with authority here. I'm just speaking on basis of what I read, and he said, well, people want to blow themselves up. They have a quick death, and they, you know that it's going to be a quick death, and they're going to ascend to heaven and all that. But when they're being tortured, they will submit in more instances. This is someone obviously believed in the efficacy of torture. They will submit because the pain is so unbearable, or whether it's physical or psychological. That's the argument you hear, I think, or it sort of epitomizes what the argument would be. Mm. You want to say something here, Stephen Gray?
Yes, it's funny. I was speaking to someone from the CIA who actually was telling me back, reporting back to me a conversation within the CIA Counterterrorism Center when we first wrote these stories about these CIA planes flying around. And this person, as he recounted it, someone asked the director of the Counterterrorism Center, "Look, your planes have been exposed. You must stop this whole practice." And he said, "No, good. Let them know. Let them be afraid." And you hear about this program justified, not just about what is done to people, but as a weapon really to sort of, if you like, terrorize the terrorists, make them fear that at any moment they might be scooped away, taken away. But as the caller said, I find it very difficult to believe you can terrorize people of the the nature of these al-Qaeda leaders. I mean, I remember I was in Iraq when a friend of mine was in the hands of Zakawi, someone who was prepared to cut off with a blunt knife the heads of his hostages, you know. Someone like that, are they really going to be scared about something like rendition? You know, if we can't compete with the horror that these guys want to inflict, you know, and I don't think we should.
The same people who, you know, behead Danny Pearl and, you know, talking about that kind of...
Exactly.
Trevor Paglen, are you still spotting these planes? Are you still in the business, so to speak?
Well, they've changed it around a little bit, how they do it, so you have to use different techniques now. But I think the kind of implicit in the conversation just now was the difference between a covert program and an overt program. And in September 2006, Bush basically came out and said, yes, we've been doing this. We have these black sites around the world. We're transferring these guys to Guantanamo Bay, but this program is still ongoing. And I think that that's quite significant, that difference between a covert program and an overt program. If you have a covert program, you sort of are implicitly acknowledging the fact that you're doing something illegal. That's why it's a covert operation. Now it's an overt operation to a certain extent. That makes me very, very nervous.
Tell us a little bit, if you would, about this whole kind of international subculture of train spotters. It's a movie. Plane spotters. I mean, who helped discover this? And who are these people?
Well, it's a weird hobby that people have, where people kind of hang out at airports and pay attention to the aircraft that land and take off, that sort of thing. I think a lot of people from the UK is really a kind of hotspot for this sort of thing. But what ended up happening was that people would just generate these records of what aircraft had taken off and landed at different places. A lot of the people that do this hobby actually work in the aviation industry. One of the things, funny enough, that happened was when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan started, people in the aviation industry ended up being stationed in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and continued to do this plane spotting thing. And so they would, you know, you'd find things about weird airplanes that they'd noticed in Basra, Iraq, or in Kabul, Afghanistan, that sort of thing. And it was another way to document the existence of these planes in different places.
Any attempts by authorities to impede this or to cause it to stop and desist?
Not that I'm aware of. And to tell you the truth, I'm not sure that this plane spotting thing is a huge part of the story. But you could get that same data from public sources as well.
On the internet today, I would imagine that's the case. Yeah. Roger, join us. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. You know, what happened in France is what is happening in this country. Americans are losing their confidence in their country. They're losing their belief in their country. That is probably one of the greatest dangers of this kind of behavior from our government. You know, to me it's like this. It's never paid off. It really has never paid off. When you make a deal with the devil, or you deal with evil, you don't win. You can't win. Eventually, you lose. The Japanese lost with their torture. The Germans lost with their torture. We'll probably lose with our torture. The Israelis lost with their torture. They have never had peace since 1948, constant war. And they have utilized all kinds of methods to gain information.
Does come back to haunt, that's for sure. And Roger, thank you for your call, and we'll go to more of your calls here. We go to Chuck. Morning.
Morning. Thanks very much. My understanding of the nature and the strategies of al-Qaeda is that they're focused on a very few but very high-impact operations And that could go a long way towards explaining why there hasn't been a repeat. We haven't seen to this point a repeat of 9/11, even though and the fact that, as I think you observed earlier, the Bush administration doesn't want to give us any specifics about numbers of how many plots have been foiled makes me suspect that perhaps they just haven't been there haven't been that many mounted since 9/11, which probably they saw as very effective. And the goal of these operations, I believe, is to elicit a repressive response because that has the effect of strengthening their movement, and I think they succeeded in that quite up to any expectations they might have had. And thirdly, I think that the structure of groups like Al-Qaeda is one of isolated cells, and it's a very distributed structure, so that even if you were to be able to get information from a person you had in custody, it would the value of that information in terms of the whole structure would be very limited. So I think that although you guys have done a great job of pointing out how this is not a very effective strategy in the war on terror, I think that when you consider those facts having to do with the goals of Al-Qaeda and their structure, it becomes even less effective.
I was
Stephen Gray.
I spoke to someone from British intelligence, and he pointed to me to a document written by a communist from Venezuela, Carlos Minghella. He wrote a book called The Manual of the Urban Guerrilla, a mini manual of urban guerrilla. And he describes the tactics which I think terrorist groups use worldwide. They start with very small groups, and what he said, which most people didn't dare write down, was their actual aim of carrying out attacks was to encourage repression. That specifically, they're trying to encourage the reprisal. So all the civilian population, all the people who might be, you know, vaguely supportive but aren't prepared to go as far as they are, get swept into the movement.
I think that was true about bin Laden in part. I mean, you know, he wanted essentially to hit the United States for all kinds of reasons, but from what we know of things that he's written and that have been transcribed from conversations, he thought that it would lead to repression in Islamic countries and there would be more revolt, and particularly countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Whenever I see a measure passed in Congress or the British Parliament, I think the question to ask is, what would bin Laden want? You know, actually, is this something that's going to help or hinder bin Laden? And I think quite often he'd want these measures to be passed because they're going to recruit more people to his cause.
This is a question from a listener who says, what happens to the Americans who are ordered to participate or ignore inhumane actions like these? Does it affect them for the rest of their lives? Well, certainly you've talked to a lot of them, haven't you, Stephen? I mean, you get remorse and contrition and feelings of complicity and all that.
It makes people ineffective. I mean, Jack Devine, a former head of Operation CIA, said, you know, what he worries about is the people who did the torture. What happens to the executioner after the execution? You know, these people are unemployable after they take part in these kind of actions.
What is, where is George Solomon now, the guy from Syria that you write about? Do we know what happened to this guy? Or?
Well, in Syria, he's probably been promoted. He's a torturer.
Working for Bashar Assad, personally. Kama is joining us from Wilmington, North Carolina. Good morning.
Hi there. I have a question about comparing what's going on with this torture today and trying to get this information, whatever information they're trying to get out of these supposed terrorists, with the Spanish Inquisition and other religious experiences where they tortured people and basically suggested to them what they were supposed to admit to doing. And I don't understand how we can even assume that anything they're saying is true, because I'm the biggest wimp in the world. If you were to tickle me, I would admit to anything. So that's my question.
Okay. Anybody want to respond?
Well, that's
Trevor Paglen.
That's exactly right. I mean, again, this Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi case is a perfect illustration of that. A guy who's kidnapped, tortured in Egypt, and starts making up stories about Saddam Hussein supplying Al-Qaeda with chemical weapons and training them, that sort of thing.
There's a listener who probably speaks for a lot of other listeners. Denise says, am I mistaken in believing that the United States is a signatory of the Convention Against Torture? Adherence to this convention is easy when we don't feel threatened. The real standard by which we are measured is how well we abide by them in challenging times. The United States under the Bush administration has thrown the values the United States has always stood for out the window. Ray says, allegedly there's a Bay Area aviation company that flies extraordinary rendition prisoners to far-off lands. Any knowledge of that? And if so, can you name the company?
The name of the company is Jepson Data Plan, which is a subsidiary of Boeing. It's based in San Jose. And they don't exactly fly the flights. They do all the flight planning, book hotels, that sort of thing. Actually, filing a flight plan is relatively complicated. You have to calculate the amount of fuel you want, airspeed, what the weather is doing, it's quite involved, and the CIA subcontracts that to a company called Jepson in San Jose, as well as other companies.
There's a listener who says, I wonder why there's opposition to torture but not nuclear weapons, bombing civilians, use of landmines that will remain for years and maim innocent people. Is torture worse than those? You know, we're talking about maybe different kinds of things that have terrible consequences. Jane writes, many years ago, the U.S. government reviewed and decided that torture was a bad policy to permit. The review resulted in their signing up for the policies of the Geneva Convention. What's different now that would change that attitude? What percentage of torture is more about punishment than learning information? I think it's a good question. I think a lot of it probably may have to do with punishment, getting back at the bad guys and all that.
Yeah, we have to remember that...
Post 9/11, I mean, yeah.
Torture is effective. It may not be effective to... illicit information, but it is effective in terrorizing whole populations. And it also wins confessions. I mean, if you want to legitimize what you're doing, it's mighty useful to have a series of confessions that allow you to justify your actions in detaining all kinds of people. And I think you see that potentially in Guantanamo, where people have confessed, and those confessions will now be used to justify their continued detention.
Stephen Gray's film can be... I'm sorry, you want a final word here?
I just wanted to say that it does something else as well, is that it's an extraordinary claim of executive power. A president that can order torture can do anything, really. I mean, the reason torture is such a poignant symbol is because it's not controversial. Civilization decided hundreds of years ago that this is not something to be done. And to claim that you can do it is an extraordinary claim.
Well, if you're the decider... Then right. You can decide. Let me thank you both for being with us. Again, Trevor Paglen's the author with A.C. Thompson of Torture Taxi on the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights, and Stephen Gray is the author of Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA rendition and torture program. You can see the film he directed this evening, PBS Frontline World's Extraordinary Rendition, which airs tonight at 10 p.m. on Channel 9, KQED Television. I want to thank our guests and thank you, our listeners. We're pleased to have you here with us and thankful that you are. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Also, thanks to Tina Lauerberg. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.